This is the agenda for this session. I'm going to do a little introduction that talks about the Health Alert Network. And then we have case studies about how the Health Alert Network is being used right now. I'm going to do one in New York, Wyoming, California. CDC is going to give the CDC view, and then we're going to have some time for open discussion and talk a little bit about how the Health Alert Network has been used for H1N1. 1999 was a big year. Shakespeare in Love won the Academy Award for Best Picture. It was the year of the Columbine school shooting. And SpongeBob SquarePants made his debut. It was also the year when we were able to apply for a CDC grant, Focus Area E, which was Health Alert Network and Training. And you can tell this is my copy because you can see the coffee stain on the lower right-hand corner. In the first Health Alert Network Focus Area E grants, 36 states were funded, and the goals were to improve information, communications, and training infrastructure in local and state health agencies, link community responders to public health agencies, develop knowledge management systems, and support exemplar sites for advanced public health practice. We did a little quick and dirty state of the state HON survey. And you can tell it was sort of quick and dirty because we got 37 responses. We actually got 49, but some of those didn't have anything to do with the Health Alert Network, and I think they were just participating. Thanks to Kevin Craddock back there, who managed to get it up on SurveyMonkey, and we pulled it together. But this isn't science. This is just sort of interesting because we didn't do much testing. We asked the states, in what year did their state or territory send its first message called a health alert? And you can see that 99, 2000, 2001, 2000, that there has been a gradual increase as time has gone on, and that we're still picking up a few states in 2007. Where's HON located in your organization? Is this an IT thing? Is it emergency preparedness? Is it communications? In most cases, in the largest number of cases, it's in emergency preparedness and that sort of organizational unit within the state health department. Information technology comes next, infectious disease, and then I think that's one in communications office. In 2008, how many HON messages, that could be alerts, advisories, or updates, did your organization send? Way more than half sent more than 30. And then we wanted to know how independently states were using their health alert networks. Were they using them just to forward on CDC health alerts, or were they using them independently? And we found that a great number of them actually originate their own state-level messages that they send on. And from a number of states, local agencies also originate their own local health alert messages. Where does the Health Alert Network fit in your agency's incident command structure? We're all sort of fussing with that now. In classic incident command structure, communications, that part of communications does fit in operations, and you can see that most of the states that responded, it is in operations. Some are in logistics, some are in planning, and some it's part of the command staff, finance and administration, and there are still some that HON is not a part of the incident command structure. Minnesota is one of those sort of outliers in the comments. The message is created in planning, it's dispatched in operations, and the infrastructure is supported in logistics. So it seemed fair to sort of split it up a little bit. Is your HON system used beyond the health and medical domain? And this is trying to get at how much bang are we getting for our buck? How much is this infrastructure being used beyond sending Health Alert Network message? And as you can see, there are a lot of states that are using this infrastructure for other things, and we're going to hear some examples of that. We are all struggling, and I bet you are too, with making sure that we're reaching populations that are historically difficult to reach with our H1N1 messages. The only quick and dirty question I could think for that was tribal governments. And As you can see, that most health alert networks do include a large number, if not all, of the tribal governments in their jurisdictions, and there are some that don't have tribal nations in their jurisdictions. I'd like to talk a little bit about the successes. We asked the people who completed the survey what were the successes and what were the challenges. Healthcare providers and public health partners rely on HAN for detailed information about outbreaks. They're getting the information that they need. The creation of network of state HAN systems, those HAN systems that communicate from state to state. In my humble opinion, this is where the real public health value is coming from. The third bullet is a state that's using their health alert network to do activation of their department operations center. They're able to locate the chiefs in incident command. And wide adoption by many state and local agencies. Challenges. 12 of the respondents said the major challenge is no dedicated funding for the health alert network. HAN information systems should be interconnected. The implementation of cascade alerting is one of the most important aspects of public health preparedness. And then dealing with growth, demand, and changing technology. There's always this sort of punishment that comes with success. If people see something is working, there's an expectation that it's going to be bigger and better next year. I want to just say just a word about language. We're talking about the Health Alert Network here, and you've heard a lot about communities of practice this week, and the communications and alerting community of practice is, of course, the Health Alert Network. There's a lot to be said for a brand. There's a very strong national brand that comes with Health Alert Network. I'll never forget the first time when I heard HAN used as a verb. A local health department person called me and said, well, aren't you going to HAN that? It's like, and so even though we do embrace a community of practice and we think that's going to be very effective for us, we're a little possessive about the Health Alert Network brand because it works so well for our local health departments, our healthcare providers, and we're also a little proprietary about the term alert. We don't want to turn into Xerox or Kleenex where anybody can just use the term alert in order to get some fast action. So if you see HAN coordinators sort of get their back up when you talk about an alerting system that isn't the Health Alert Network, that's why. There's a community of practice business meeting tomorrow, and we encourage you to come. It's late, and I know some of you have flights out, but we'll go out to dinner after and have fun or something. And it's always a good time to meet people whose voices you hear on the telephone and put faces to voices.
I think it's 5 to 7:30. Is that right, or did I screw that up?
Did Kevin screw it up? Who knows for sure? I promise before the end of the presentation, we'll have the accurate time for you. You know, it's 5-ish tomorrow sometime. Oh, Kevin. Jet lag.
It's on page 69 of the
book. All right. These are the presentations that we have for you today. They're just sort of snippets about how the health alert was used in a particular jurisdiction sometime within the last year or so. I'm going to go first since I'm up here, and then we're going to introduce each other and try to keep things rolling, and we'll do questions at the end. And there's my cartoon. Sort of feel like him. I'm going to talk about floods. The Red River of the North floods in 2009. There's also a Red River that's in Oklahoma. Yes, Kim knows. This isn't that. It's it goes along the North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota border. It flows, I'm going to get way too much into sort of geology because I think this is so interesting, and I'll shut up when Charlie throws something at me and tells me I'm done. It flows northward, and it goes through Minnesota, North Dakota, Manitoba. It's 550 miles long, and the floodplain is very wide and flat. It's slow moving, and it's moving north, which isn't exactly uphill, but it's a very slow river. It was formed 10,000 years ago when glacial Lake Agassiz drained. Snow melt and spring rains come before the ground thaws, so there's nowhere for the thaw and the spring rains to go. And because it flows north, it's still frozen as it flows north, so there's nowhere for the water to go. It floods a lot, and the flooding refills part of that glacial Lake Agassiz. This is what it looks like. You see that twisty, curvy? It's going through Fargo Moorhead here. Up, you see. The photo on the left is from March 18th, and you can see that on March 3rd, there was a significant amount of flooding this spring. And this is around Fargo and Moorhead. It floods many times. They've done lots of mitigation, but the geography is just such that it's difficult to do enough to make it not flood. This is a picture from 1897 with it flooding. The flood crest, it's very fun to go to our State Emergency Operations Center because they talk about where the crest is. And when we hear them talking about Pembina, which is way northern North Dakota, Minnesota, then we know it's on the way out of the United States and it becomes Canada's problem. We use the Health Alert Network and its infrastructure for preparedness. Before the floods, we could see them coming for quite a while. There'd been a lot of snow. People who know about floods knew we were going to have pretty bad floods. Event documents related to response, health alert messages, and other messages using our public health directory, backup communication, and use of the infrastructure. This is our portal site. It's a secure website. We're working very hard between emergencies to try and get our new one out. This is sort of old and kludgy, but it works. And this is our active emergencies folder within that portal. And every time there's an emergency, we open a new folder for that particular emergency. You can see the RNC folder is still up there from last fall. But we called this one NOAA, 2009 Floods. And because we could see it coming for so long, there were a lot of pre-planning documents, which included lots of fact sheets for the public and preparedness things for responders. These are for responders. Big questions that always come up with floods are, do I need a tetanus vaccination? And we always say no. Is North Dakota here? Yes. And North Dakota says yes. Because North Dakota thinks this is a great opportunity to get people their vaccinations for Texas. And the Minnesota immunization people say if you've had one within 10 years, you don't need another one. So we always try and get the whole vaccination thing straight beforehand. These were public materials, and we posted them as Word documents because we wanted local health departments to be able to download them, add local information. When the FEMA service centers opened, they were able to add that information to the fact sheets. And we can post them as Word documents on this password portal. Behavioral health fact sheets, when terrible things happen. Helping children after the flood. Our state emergency management agency is called Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We call them HOSEM behind their back, but they like HSEM. And we always link to their situation reports. We aren't recording this, are we? Will this? No one say a word. But we put our the Minnesota Department of Health situation reports on this site also. We don't send out a lot of health alerts about, go see, there's new information here. We try to send out one message at the beginning of an event saying, this is where you go to get updated information. The situation reports will be posted every day at this time. This is where they go. We worry about Han fatigue, about sending so many health alerts out that people just start to ignore them. So we're pretty parsimonious with our health alerts. And this is the situation report that I think is from the last operational period. We use the standard ICS format. Not only did we have this sort of bad flood, but in the middle of the flood, there was a blizzard that dumped lots and lots of very wet snow on the area along the Red River. The ditch was flooding and flooding the road. It was freezing on the road. It just was miserable conditions. It looks cold. We were comparing this to the wildfire photos from California, so you'll warm up later in the presentation. We only sent two official health alert messages during the floods. The first one was the Department Operations Center is activated, and the second one was we're going to dock light, which is when we scale down and just keep a few things operational. And we tried to be very good about posting things in the places we had told people where to post them. When we said they would be there. We did send quite a lot of general messages, which use the same infrastructure as the Health Alert Network. It uses a public health directory, uses a messaging center. They just come from individuals rather than from the Health Alert Network. There were information, immunization and flooding resources, a request from the governor's office, which we always try to pay attention to, flood materials, and the hot wash announcement. Have you all participated in hot washes? They're very fun. What's the number one big issue during a hot wash? Communication, yes. We use backup and tactical communications quite a bit. You may or may not know that most states are trying to build out 800 megahertz radio so that it's a nationwide system. We haven't quite gotten there in Minnesota. It's a big state and we have some difficult topography. But we have satellite phones, and we've got two Iridiums that work, and we have like 14 global stars that anyone can have for really cheap. And we have a strong amateur radio community. The 800 megahertz has not reached the Red River Valley. There is a communications van that has a portable 800 megahertz tower. But they don't deploy that until after the governor has declared a disaster, because it costs a couple $1,000 as soon as you turn the key, so they won't be reimbursed for deploying it. This is something that we're working on so that we can use that sort of communication. The Han infrastructure also includes an autocall system that we use for health alerts for after-hours messages, but our Medical Reserve Corps, the ESRVIP, uses it to call up volunteers. Our food, beverage, and lodging division within the health department uses it to send phone calls to 12,000 restaurants in the state about take the peanut butter off the menu. In this case, they used it. There was some power outages, and they used it for those restaurants that had lost power because of the floods. And our department, the Minnesota Department of Health Human Resources Division uses it for staff notifications. We just started that and we're pretty excited about it. The password protected portal is called the Workspace. And as you saw, we have an active emergencies folder with the SITREPs. There's also a communications go pack that's sort of tucked away and secure. That's for on-call staff. It has all the instructions about how to send the autocall messages and do all the things we need to do. And planning minutes, materials, there are always a lot of conference calls during emergencies, and we try to take good notes of those and keep those on the workspace. This is something that we weren't responsible for, but I loved it so much that I thought I would show it to you. This is from twitter.com, Fargo Flood. And they use Twitter to notify people who are willing to do sandbagging about where to show up on the line, because the line would get weak at a particular point. They'd need sandbaggers there right away, and they would use Twitter to locate them. I thought it was a brilliant use of that technology. We can't say hello in less than 140 characters, but there are some things that I think it does work for. Just a few more flood pictures. What a mess. There, one city was evacuated, the small town of Georgetown. We also evacuated a nursing home, which was quite an experience. I put this picture in here because it shows the value of paper still in some things. There's nothing like having a map up on the wall. And you can see the Red River snaking through Georgetown. Our concerns for the next 10 years, overuse. Every important public health message is not a health alert message. Doesn't mean we can't use the infrastructure, but our local health departments just stop everything when they get a health alert and do what we're asking them to do, and we want to continue that. Maintaining and enhancing the infrastructure without any dedicated funding. Incorporating incident command system into the HON roles. Mobile commuting, we are very behind on that. I was thrilled to see that EpiX is offering to put their certificates on our Blackberries. I got mine done. If you go to the exhibit area, they'll do yours if you have it with you. And radio communication, it's just such an important backup system, and it's not something historically that health departments have a lot of expertise in. I put in this picture because their vests in Clay County, which is Moorhead, are so much more attractive than ours at the Minnesota Department of Health. Ours are sort of blue polyester, very ugly. This is very nice. And this is what it looks like after you sandbag for a while. And so I put in this picture of sandbagging. Our next speaker is my friend, Deb Sotolano, and she's going to talk about the use of the Health Alert Network in New York State.
Well, I'm known usually for, first off, how do you switch the slides on this?
Okay.
I'm known usually for 6,000 slides, so 10 minutes and a few slides is really a challenge for me. So I really hope that I'm not going to drive you crazy with speaking too fast. But so let me just go ahead and. Our Health Alert Network was operational since 2002. We developed our software in-house, and like all of the other Health Alert Networks, we're 24/7 capacity for both general alerts, which means we can blast out to all of our commerce users, and I'll talk about numbers in a moment, or we can target our alerts, and when people come to see our alerts on our secure site, only those individuals targeted at that for that particular alert can actually even know it's there. So that's for really sensitive information. We do use multiple communication modes. We have our phone, various phones, and like Merla, we're doing a fire sale on our global star satellite phones. We use all types of phones, however, and we gather information for home phones and various home phone modalities. But for phone and email, we're able to record acknowledgments, and we do a lot of statistical analysis on that. We can use numeric pagers, and we have a secure web posting. We do use text-to-speech for our outbound messages or pre-recorded messages. We have both capabilities, although text-to-speech gets that very interesting recorded voice, which is usually a challenge when it reads a phone number as if it was just a numeric digit somewhere in the millions. But we also provide, that's our manual alerting process. We have a web interface, and you can go in and create an alert. We also have a generic interface that provides a module that applications can use so that we're not rebuilding alerting modules in every application that needs to send out some type of a notification. And so we do use XML file formats and web services to accomplish health alerting for some of our other applications, such as laboratory test alerting. We have, for both our public health and clinical partners, we do health surveys to and a lot of emergency incident activations of our health facilities. Those all go out automatically. Our volunteer management and our syndromic surveillance all use the alerting, the back end, so to speak, alerting capability. And our infrastructure, as I mentioned, we have the web-based application and the back end. We use two interactive voice response servers that enable load balancing and failover, so we can either surge all the way up to the capacity of both, and we have two T1 lines on each, so that we have a total of 96 lines, and they can load balance, and they deduplicate, so they're not both trying to call the same person. And so we have a good system availability and reliability. We do have a third-party service that we can use in a surge, and we're working to try to make an automated process to that surge as well. It's many hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to surge additional capacity that would not be used all that often. So we have two digital fax appliances, 24 lines each, and we use our Lotus Notes servers for our emails. We send out our notifications to roles, and we have customized roles to our facilities that are in our public health directory. We send it to specific persons, and we can construct predefined lists of people based on a subject. So this is the, you know, oil spill list of contacts. And all of our different program areas are using this alert system, so they have been doing a lot of customization of lists. We have over 150 different types of public health, healthcare organizations, and emergency response organizations that utilize our health commerce system, which is our secure site. When somebody gets an account on that system, they automatically are entered in the public health directory. So at a minimum, we could contact them using our notification system at their business hours, phone, email, and fax. And as you can see further down, we also capture for emergency contacts up to 6 phone numbers, 2 additional emails, and an additional fax. So we do have a pretty robust means of continuing to try to call people if we don't get a hit on the first pass through. We also have reports that build immediately. So as soon as people start confirming their emails or their phone confirmations, we build reports at the role, person, and organization level, and we know approximately how they responded, what device they confirmed on, and how quickly they responded. And we do a lot of stats on that. We have sent over 4,000 alerts since we've begun our system. We use those term alerts, advisories, informational messages, updates, and drills. We don't call everything an alert. We usually call them notifications, and these are different levels of notification. We have over 650 users who are trained to send alerts. We do have a certification program that they have to go through. We offer webinar-based training, and you can see the majority of our users are actually at the local public health departments, which is a real important thing for us because we do cascade alerts to them, and we do require in our grant deliverables every year that they participate in both cascading alerts, that we send them a message and they re-triage out, or that we just ask them to generate a message on their own to their local partners. So it keeps them in tune with the system, and I'll talk a little bit about how they've used it, and it also just keeps in the better process of incident management as it should be. So local public health departments use it for local business needs, and a lot of them have asked us to add different types of organizations onto our public health directory so that they can better expand it for local use. One of our counties, Broome County, asked us to load all of their local restaurants because they're now using it for their boil water advisories. We do use it also for our volunteer management, recruitment, and notification, as I mentioned earlier. So, local health departments are very keenly interested in school nurses and physicians, and we've been doing a lot of different creative ways of recruiting our physicians and our practitioners. We have about 43,000 on, we're about a little over half of our physicians are on now, but they are a group that are hard to get on, but that we need to get on very much so. So we're working closely with our local health departments on that as well. Local public health, I wanted to bring up this incident. I'm giving you just little snippets of the way we've used the system. In Erie County, we had a plane crash in mid-February, May. You may have heard about that. And there were fatalities. And this occurred late at night, 10:20 p.m. But the reason that I like this incident so much is because we didn't do a thing for it at the State Health Department. I didn't know about the use of the HON until the next morning when Monroe County contacted me. And that's because there's a mutual aid agreement between Monroe County and Erie County, especially for their medical examiners. Erie alerted Monroe. Monroe alerted at 1:35 in the morning their medical examiner group. And they received phone calls back from all of the people that they alerted. And what we tracked in the alerting system was about a confirmation time of about 20 minutes on the alerted by phone. On the email response, you'll see 7 hours, and that's because they were still asleep. So unless they really had it glued to their head, they didn't see the email. But it's always there. It's a good backup. And when they did wake up, they would have had it there. So we really are like that incident very much. Now, at the State Health Department, for our H1N1, and I want to highlight this as well because there is a lesson learned here that Merla also has already mentioned. Between April 24th and June 1st, we transmitted 309 separate H1N1-related alerts and notifications to almost 400,000 recipients. And generally, we always put up a website with an emergency on our secure site where we put all our documents and different kinds of information. And basically, we did the same kinds of notifications, guidance, changes in guidance, changes in guidance, changes in guidance, survey activations, conference call, briefings, announcements, webinars, all of the things I have listed here. And they would also appear on that special website, but we would make an announcement. And our average response times were anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour and a half, with about close to 100% always on our local health departments and hospitals, which are some of our key users. And we tracked the number of downloads, and we had over 400,000 documents downloaded during that period of time by our users. But as Merla said, there's this HON fatigue. And one of the things that our emergency preparedness director, Bob Berhans, has said is that when we go forward, we're going to use a strategy of a routinized notification for all these kinds of things. And that is very good because it will highlight when a real emergency comes through. So they'll know, like, every Tuesday and Thursday at 3 o'clock, your routinized documents, your updates, everything's coming through. If it's an emergency, it'll come whenever it needs to, but you're going to know at that point that it's an emergency and you're going to have to pay attention to it instead of waking up and finding 20 versions and everything, you know, joggling in your head. And I'm getting a student to help me with that project, which I'm very happy about. State emergency response in Binghamton, we had another tragedy. We had shootings. And although it worked well, we sent out an activation and a deactivation because we had to let the hospitals in 7 counties know about this event, prepare to take maybe gunshot wounds and things of that nature. And 90% of them confirmed receipt of the notification. But I was almost not wanting to send it out because internally, instead of the health departments doing it, which they would have zapped it out probably, we took over an hour and a half to 2 hours to decide the wording of the notification so that by the time it went out, the hospitals were very surely aware of it and prepared. The system worked great, but the people part of the process is something we still very much need to refine. We also had a very serious ice storm in December this year, and there were some places that were without power and everything for over a week or close to 2 weeks. We activated in 16 counties all of our nursing homes and hospitals, and we tracked them for their critical supplies, what their EDs were doing, because we had fear of a lot of carbon monoxide reports as well as hypothermia, and also just to see how these facilities were doing. We sent out an activation for a survey response, and 100% of the hospitals confirmed the notification. They confirmed in a mean time of 11 minutes, and the maximum time it took to confirm was 25. And 100% of the follow-up activity was get on the website, report this critical data. 100% responded to the survey, and they did that within 41 minutes. So within less than 2 hours, we pretty much started to have a sense of what was going on at the facilities. That was the hospitals. They've been a longtime partner. Nursing homes are slowly getting to be more, people thought nursing homes didn't know even what a computer was. That's not really true. I want to defunct that myth. They still are a little bit behind in using the site, and our long-term care office has helped us by saying, if you're going to get a Dear Administrator letter or anything like that, you're going to come to the Commerce website to get it. We're no longer snail mailing it out. So those kinds of enforcements are helping us. But 95% of the nursing homes did confirm the notification, and they did so in 43 minutes, which is still really good. Only 62% actually got in and did the survey, so we had to beat them up a little bit, I guess. And it took them a little bit longer, 2 hours and 6 minutes for that group to get in. So evaluation is really important for us on the use of this network, and I started looking at some of our data, and I know it's very tiny and I'm sorry, but this first little chart just shows you, I just was looking at hospitals, nursing homes, and local health departments. Local health departments have been our partners on our website for 12 years, back to the info grant that was really ancient history. But so they really started out, as you can see the blue line, pretty good response. Our hospitals, the red line, they started off slow, but with all of our herds, we call our system herds, in which they do their survey, all those activations and all of the other measures we've taken, and you can see they're right up there along with the local health departments in terms of the percent that are confirming their alerts. The nursing homes, you can see, starting really low, but in recent events, they really have embraced it, and with the help of the Office of Long-Term Care, they've really become a very important partner, and they actually like it, which is great and amazing to us. So we've been working, we have a chapter out on our Health Alert Network, and we're working on a journal article, which we're close to completing. I'm looking at, from the literature, some of the predictors that might make an alert more successful. And our two key outcome variables, and Merla and I have been talking about impact on public health all week, are, you know, the percent of users confirming it so you know they got it and you reached the group you needed to reach, and the mean confirmation time so that they got it in a very timely way to respond. I started to look at some other data, and that second chart is actually showing you the increase in the percent confirming based on the number of modes of contact you used. So whether you just used email, whether you used fax email, whether you used fax email, all phone types, things like that. And you can see it starts to go up. That could be spurious, so that's why we want to look at all these different factors that came out of the literature and try to come up with a model that shows you what kinds of characteristics will help to get better success in your alerts. And that's what we're working on. So our lessons learned, training, routine use, familiarity, that's huge, because the more people know it and come, it gets easier and easier. And that's we talked earlier when we were preparing the presentations, our commissioner back in 2005 following the 9/11 attacks did an emergency regulation which made all of our Article 28, 36, and 40 facilities required to come to Commerce, have accounts, and also to keep their contact information updated, which we require every 90 days on our site. That helped us tremendously in getting our facilities, and we're trying to do more of that now with our H1N1 as well. The sense of ownership, with the local health departments, that example, because it's something they can use, something they have control in helping us build and modify. That makes a huge difference. So if you can get it in the hands of your other users, that's a very good plus. With success comes some strain on the system. We're getting hundreds of, you know, all these thousands and thousands of users, 80,000 users. It starts to show up, and you have to go back and continuously tweak and tweak and tweak. And we were starting to see some real timeouts in terms of the size of the XMLs that were being produced, and so we had to go back and look at our basic code and our basic SQL statements. We were able to reduce the email output from getting 1 to 2 emails out per second to getting 7 to 8 out per second. So just that tweaking and that, but it's a constant process and can be very costly as well. These are not cheap types of architecture. Limitations on communication infrastructure. We do run these drills with our local health departments in our alternate communications drill. The idea of radio came up, very important. We have been doing a lot of work with radio and enhancing it. One thing I can mention that we've been working with the MARS, with the military radio, and we've been working with them with a software, and I'm gonna remember the name, is Winlink 2000. And it actually enables you to generate an email, which then gets transmitted as a radio and comes back in as an email. So we're working to integrate that into with our health alert network as well as enhancing radio capacity. And cultural shifts are real important. You know, fax was the big thing and still is used, but not as much. Now people are looking for that text message, and physicians especially are saying, I don't want to log in. I want the content and I want it on my BlackBerry, you know, and that's for us a decision, because all of our hands have always said we're not sending out sensitive contact information in our notification, while the physicians are saying, hey, unless it's a real sensitive thing, just send it to me. So we're kind of making some decisions about that, but really keeping that cultural shift in the way people are communicating, like Merlid showed with the Twitter. That's really important. And the diversity of our target organizations and their capacities and so forth is always a challenge, but important to try to know your audience and how best to reach them is important, I think, lesson learned as well. And that's my presentation. So, thank you. So now is Paul Card from Wyoming Department of Health.
The least populous state sandwiched between the two most populous states. I wonder if there's a message there someplace. I'll let them fight about it later. That's their department. Okay. Very brief business overview of the WIHON, or Wyoming Health Alert Network. We started in 2000 with a Windows 3.1 Microsoft based system, 8 analog lines with about 100 people, fax only through a blast fax program that I have since forgotten the name and don't want to know anymore. A couple of years ago, the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Program presented a budget and finally got it signed. And we purchased a vendor-based application. It was activated in June of 2007. It allows for, of course, fax, phone, pager, email capabilities. We now have 48 digital phone lines and a secure website, and have upped our participation to about 3,600 users. The focus of my case study, as it were, is to demonstrate collaboration between state agencies. The Wyoming Division of Criminal Investigation, commonly known as the DCI, it also has other names for people who are on the other side of the court docket, but those of us call it just the DCI, is a separate operating division of the Wyoming Attorney General's Office. And it was assigned, given, coerced, I'm not sure what the correct term was, but anyway, it is the lead agency for the Wyoming Amber Alerts. In those days, it was a very young system, and as of January 21st, 2004, the Amber Alert was instituted and implemented in the state of Wyoming. Within 36 hours of that implementation, an Amber Alert was initiated at the request of Utah law enforcement officers. About 4 hours later, the abducted child was located unharmed and the person arrested in Rawlins, Wyoming, which is right on the southern edge of Wyoming. a very small town. At the time, and until I continue my talk, the DCI's method of sending out information for Amber Alerts to about 30 law enforcement officers at the time was to take the message, put it into a fax machine, punch in the number, it would transmit the fax, take that, put it around again, punch in the next number, and repeat and repeat. That worked for a long time. However, a short time later, the Wyoming Broadcasters Association said, you know, this is a worthwhile community project, and we would like to assist you in disseminating Amber Alerts via radio and television news spots. Well, that increased the number of participants of people and agencies to about 300. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to stand in front of a fax machine that long. So the DCI had heard of the Health Alert Network. Part of it is their IT person is my boss. So they came for a little visit and said, we need to have some way of communicating this information out to about these 300 people. What do you use? And they, with all intents and purposes, had already tried and budgeted some money to figure out their best solution. My solution was use the Health Alert Network. It was approved, going up channels, and in a very short time, a memorandum of understanding, MOU, was created, signed by the officials of both departments and everybody that needed to. It's 7 pages. There are 2 pages of protocol, 2 pages of definitions, 2 pages of signatures, yes, I do agree to, whatever, and then on the back is the sign that says 1 page left intentionally blank. I don't know, that lawyers got in that one, I'm sure. The cost-saving factor for the DCI at the time and subsequently met the spirit of a memo that the governor had issued requesting cooperation between agencies wherever possible. It was like, you play nice or else. Training was provided to specific DCI agents and personnel, and they do send out their own Amber Alerts. Let's see. This relationship has worked out quite well. There have been a total of 6 Amber Alerts issued from the state of Wyoming. All children have been recovered unharmed. All children have been recovered unharmed, except there were some very tragic circumstances. So those children are getting some help that they need. And of course, the perpetrators were arrested. This relationship has worked so well that a new, last month, new memorandum of understanding was written and just is now becoming implemented on a category that we class as endangered persons. To be issued an Amber Alert is very strict criteria. The person, the children, what relationship, a vehicle description, and some other criteria. Endangered persons sometimes don't meet that very strict criteria. So what we've done is we've allowed a little looser interpretation, still using the same facilities, and an example would be, of course, an Alzheimer person that may have wandered away from their home or facility, and of course, this also covers all ages, not just children, as in the Amber Alert. One of the more recent, and we're working on it now, applications is that the Wyoming National Guard has approached us with the concept and to see if we could do something feasibly to notify members of the Wyoming National Guard of real-world events and any other notifications, you know, like you leave for Iraq tomorrow morning. There are 1,400 Wyoming National Guardsmen, and we are in the process of training National Guardsmen, yes, that's not a oxymoron, to reply and respond to their alerts. Lessons learned. State agencies need to communicate with each other, and especially if they happen to have some kind of a common or identical goal. This, of course, enables reduction in expenditures by sharing the cost and deduplication of efforts and equipment, and it makes the governor just so happy that other agencies are cooperating. Next, I would like to introduce Tiffany McGee and Julie Witten from California.
Okay, so are there anyone in the audience from the western part of the United States? Any? Few? All right, so we've got some colleagues here from the west. So we want to go ahead and get started. You've heard about the different HAN systems, and in California, our HAN system is in the Department of Public Health, the Emergency Preparedness Office. And the section that we're part of is actually, we have two sections, or two units in the section, and one's a KHAN unit, and one deals with emergency communication, so with the radio, the IT infrastructure for the Joint Emergency Operations Centers, et cetera. And Tiffany McGee is here with me, and she'll be speaking as well. We're kind of doing a little tag team, and she is our State Health Alert Network Coordinator for California. So thank you for having us. We just wanted to give you an overview. KHAN, our California Health Alert Network, so we refer to it as KHAN, is the state of California's official alerting system. It is web-based, like the others that you've heard. It's 24/7, it's secure, and we use it to distribute information. We assist with the preparedness planning and other initiatives. We also provide training. So we administer the Health Alert Network, and then we provide training on a statewide basis for anyone that is using the system. I just want to point out we have 184 phone lines and 8 fax lines that we use for the system. I've heard other people give that information as well. All right, so an example of our participants. We have participants from the federal level, so we have CDC as a participant of our system, border jurisdictions that are surrounding us, different government agencies, our department, our sister department, the healthcare services area, Emergency Medical Services Authority, our local emergency medical services agencies, and local health departments. We have 61 local health departments in California. We also have long-term care facilities, like you've heard others have on the system, our Indian health clinics, law enforcement, first responders, hospitals, schools, clinics. Some of our local health departments have all police, all fire. Some are very organized, have pretty much everyone in their county on the system that relate to public health and emergency response. There's been an increased emphasis in the grants on having the ability to communicate both horizontally and vertically. And so we use KHAN as a method to meet those requirements, because we can communicate with our peers and colleagues on a local, state, and federal level. So let's talk about this slide. We have some other information to add.
Sure. So what we thought we would do is sort of illustrate where our Health Alert Network lies within our department. So Julie sort of gave an overview of that being within the California Department of Public Health, but more specifically in the office, in our Emergency Preparedness Office. So we sort of split this in two different sections, our state and our local partners. So as an example, at the state level, we have our Department of Healthcare Services, our Emergency Medical Services Authority, and then our California Emergency Management Agency, which is our Homeland Security and then Office of Emergency Services as well. So what this illustrates is within CDPH, we can send alerts up to our state partners and then down to our local partners as well. And so the groups we put on as an illustration are our healthcare providers. And so not only can alerts be sent down to the local health departments, but then cascaded down to the healthcare facilities as well, or it can go directly from the state to the local facilities. And then these arrows illustrate, we have different ways of alerting. We have something for the horizontal alerting, and we have established what we call peer-to-peer alerting. So for example, we have established roles throughout the state, and one of those, for example, is a health officer. So each county would have a health officer, and we have that set up so the health officer of a particular county could actually alert other health officers within the county on a regional basis or statewide. And then our public health partners, that could be local EMS, they could alert up to the state. They could also alert the healthcare providers as well. So it's really multi-directional, but it works for us. Okay, so we're gonna switch back to Julie for one slide and then we'll have a short video as well.
So here you can see where our CAHAN system has evolved from, and Tiffany and I both started the end of 2006. So we've seen this change happen, pretty dramatic change, because as you can see in 2003, we didn't have any alerts at all issued. That must have been a nice year. because now we have so many alerts that it's hard to keep up sometimes. And we'll go over some of the other information. But as you can tell, we're now approaching close to 25,000 participants on our CAHAN system statewide. We predict that we'll be close to 30,000 by the end of December. And it looks like we will get close to probably around 5,000 alerts by the end of the year as well. So it's increased dramatically, so we're kept very busy, and we keep wondering what it would have been like to work there in 2003. But we do have statewide health alert network coordinators, just so everyone knows how our setup works in California. So we have 61 health alert network coordinators throughout the state. We hold a monthly conference call with all the HON coordinators, and that really keeps them in the loop. So if we have to upgrade the system, we're making some changes, we want to share some other information, they're constantly kept in the loop every month we have that call. And it's the same time, same day of the month, so everyone knows it's on their calendar all year long. And because of the HON coordinators, it's a decentralized system. So if you're at a local health department, you're kind of in charge of your system there. You can send out alerts, et cetera. And then we were thinking earlier, we should have called this session Floods, Ice, and Fire. So we'll go over the 2008 wildfires.
So our case study that we did was the wildfires. And prior to the fire that's happening right now, we thought it'd be really good to show a video, sort of frame what was happening in 2008. If any of you have been watching the news, you're well aware there's a pretty active fire going on right now. So we do have a short video. Hopefully this will work. It's about 3 minutes, and it's just going to give some illustration as to what was happening at that time.
We're watching the fires hopscotch from one house to another. Absolute devastation.
The firefight lasted all night as flames tore through this enclave of multi-million dollar homes. By daylight, it was clear the inferno had devoured nearly everything in its path.
It's just something that Mother Nature is in control and we aren't.
These are the worst fires in 30 years in this area, whipped by 70 mile per hour winds. They blow through the canyons, picking off house by house.
It looked like a nuclear bomb had struck, and it's unbelievable.
The fire just roared up this canyon, engulfing this house, and they've just declared it a total loss. I can't tell you how hot it is right here, but the big concern now is the neighbor's house next door.
Firefighters tried to protect it as a garage nearby blew up. 2,500 acres have been incinerated so far, and dozens of homes burned to the ground. Thousands have been evacuated, and at least three people have been taken to hospitals and treated for burns. The fire also destroyed a dormitory on a college campus in Montecito and a mountaintop monastery.
I don't think there's much left.
Jennifer Johnson lost her home of 10 years. She could barely recognize what was left.
Life deals you some tough blows, and you pick it up and keep going.
This area is also home to the rich and famous. Back to the Future star Christopher Lloyd's house was charred, while Oprah Winfrey's Montecito mansion was spared.
Unfortunately, a lot of people are going to be coming home to scenes like this one. This actually used to be somebody's front door. It's now totally destroyed. And you know, the one good thing is the winds have been relatively calm today, so firefighters are making some progress. But tonight, they say 1,500 homes in this area are still literally in the line of fire. Russ?
Ben Tracy in Montecito, California. Thank you.
So I like this video because, of course, we had to put our California celebrity spin on it and get their houses in there. So that sort of gives you an idea of what was happening. So in 2008, we actually had a really long fire season. It started in May, which is sort of early, and went through November. And in the beginning part of the year, we had a lot of fires in the northern part of the state. And then towards the end of October and beginning part of November, that was in Southern California. So the case study will sort of go into all of that because it was a continuous event. So there were nearly 3,000 individual fires and over 800,000 acres were burned. I'm not sure why we have the number 10. I didn't do that, so sorry about that. We had nearly 1,000 homes were destroyed, 23 fatalities and 32 injuries. The last bullet talking about the healthcare facilities, this is really important to us because during an activation, we work really closely with our licensing and certification division that works, of course, with our healthcare facilities. So this is something that we're always paying attention to. So during this particular event, there were 30 healthcare facilities evacuated with over 400 patients. And you can see the types of facilities listed below. So what we thought we would do, since we have a fire happening right now, sort of give you a perspective and stats of what's going on right now.
Okay, so we've already had several fires in 2009. The largest fire going on right now is the Station Fire. That's in LA County. As of this morning, it has burned 121,762 acres. Only a 5% containment, so that's our concern right now. There's been 3 injuries, 2 fatalities, 53 structures have been destroyed, but currently there have not been any healthcare facilities evacuated. So we're watching this closely. The other concern we have is we're expecting containment September 15th. That's a long way away because 2 days ago this was around 43,000 acres. In addition, the governor proclaimed a state of emergency August 28th in Los Angeles, Monterey counties, and in August 30th in Placer County. So we have several fires going on right now. So our big concern is, how do we deal with fires and H1N1 at the same time? That's always been our concern at this point.
So that's our update on what's happening right now. Back to the 2008. There were 36 alerts that were sent during the time frame from May to November, and 17 were sent at the state level and 17 at the local, and then this went to over 11,000 of our users. So there was a lot of information sent out through KAHAN. At the state level, we refer to our EOC as our Joint Emergency Operations Center. So activations and deactivations and status updates as to the level of activation. And then at the county level, we had the EOC and DOC activations, same type of thing, deactivations and status updates. Staffing requests or updates were also issued through this. We have a lot of conference calls, as you can imagine, during these events. So we use our system as a quick way to get everyone on these calls. So that usually happens during any event, and this was no different. So with the fires then, we were also dealing with our excessive heat. So there were cooling centers that were opening up around the state. And what we usually do is we will post those locations of the cooling centers on our portal, usually on the homepage. So that was happening as well. Activation of our state and local heat plans. There were shelters opening, so updates for staffing. Then, of course, you can imagine air quality is not good at this point, so we had things going out for that. Excessive smoke, and then a lot of our risk communication material. So press releases, templates, a lot of the local health departments will share that material. So if they post it within our library, they can all access that. More fact sheets, and then we had increased winds with the Santa Anas in Southern California. So, you know, we try to keep it lively in California. So if that wasn't enough, we had all of these other things happening. We had our statewide HAVBED drill. So for those of you that are not aware of what HAVBED is, there is a requirement, a federal requirement, that states have to be able to have an accurate number of available beds within 4 hours reported back to them. So we don't have one system that our state uses. So what we do actually is we use CAHAN to initiate that alert, and then our local health departments will use their existing systems and get that information back to us. So that was happening. Also, our first case of West Nile. So with that, a lot of risk communication material, press releases, templates, that comes out. We also had an earthquake in Southern California, and then a statewide disease outbreak, which actually went nationwide and I think international, I think Canada and Mexico. And then to top that off, we had 120 packages of white powder found in several counties, so we were dealing with that. And then we had a huge statewide exercise that was occurring at the same time. And CAHAN is a heavy use in that exercise. So lots of alerts, lots of use of the document library and directory happening. So I'm going to switch it back to you for lessons learned.
Okay. So we've, as we just mentioned, we're now dealing with the fires, H1N1. We have no idea what will happen next. But one of the things that we wanted to focus on, and I did want to mention, during the fires, we've had, or during H1N1, we had up to 22 conference calls a day. So, I mean, it just gets really crazy. The lessons that we learned is not all of our facilities, licensed facilities, are on the system. So it makes it really tough to try to get in touch with everyone when they're not on the system. We had several events, as Tiffany mentioned, happening at the same time. So we actually had to remove counties from this statewide Golden Guardian exercise. There's usually over 1 million participants in that statewide exercise, from the governor's office to schools everywhere. We had to remove certain counties from the exercise because they were dealing with real events, and we didn't want them to get the test alerts along with real alerts and get confused. So we had to remove and do all of that. It's really important to have your partners on before an emergency. And of course, we're always trying to do that, but not everyone understands the importance sometimes until there isn't an emergency, until there is a fire, H1N1, and you've all experienced that. So one group that we're working very closely with is our licensing and certification division, because they are the ones that license all the facilities. And we wanted to make sure all their district offices were on. And I think this year with the H1N1, they're really excited now about CAHAN, but it took a while because they could always call someone over at a district office who could call someone else. But when you're dealing with several things at once, it's much easier to just push the button and get in touch with everyone. Adequate training for participants so they know how to use the system before there's an event. That's really important. And the other piece is there's always a surge of help desk requests. So when we're going through an emergency, we have all of my staff are usually one of the first to be dispatched all over the place. And then we have a lot of people calling because they can't remember their password, they don't remember how to get into something. And so then you're posting tons of documents, you're sending out things, so it gets really crazy. And so we try to do as much of that beforehand as we can. One of the things I wanted to focus on is we're now tasked with adding 7,000 facilities. So last year we started this effort. We have about 425 hospitals. We've added almost all of them. I think we have around 100 left. And then we're adding the clinics, skilled nursing facilities, and the Indian health clinics. So that's our task at this time. Let's see. The other task we've been asked to address is our licensing and certification division would also like to add 200,000 clinicians to our system. And we actually met with them, and they gave us a memo, a draft memo. We were meeting with them one afternoon, and they said, can we send this memo out tomorrow? And I said, no, we won't be able to flip the switch and notify 200,000 people tomorrow. They won't know how to get into the system, and it'll be chaos. So we will develop a plan and share that with you, and we'll make it happen, but it's not overnight. Anyway, the other thing that we've really tried to do is focus on the structure, because we do a lot of different things, and we wanted to make sure that it's a successful program. And a lot of people take on other things. They don't have that infrastructure or foundation to keep it successful or to ever be viewed successful. So to us, it was very important that we do this right, that we have the right structure. It's amazing how long it takes to convince people that you need one dedicated help desk person, at least, to support close to 25,000 users. But yet in the IT department, you know, that's an easy thing to kind of calculate, but that took a while. So that just happened this past year. And then we added another trainer, so we have three trainers right now. And then we realized we did not have a state health alert network coordinator for California. Here we hold the calls every month for all of our local health departments and realized we didn't have one for the state. So we moved Tiffany into that role, and that's been a great help. Here is our contact information. And just so you're aware, we use EM Systems, the response manager application. That's what we're using as a vendor solution. We recently added San Diego to KHAN, and we are in the process now of working with LA, so technically California will then just have one official statewide alerting network for the state instead of various health alert networks. So we feel that that's a very efficient use of resources. I think that's it. Thank you.
So our next speaker is going to be Jim from CDC, wherever he went. There he is. Okay.
Chuck actually gets credit for this humorous cartoon, but it's a great cartoon, definitely. Well, I really appreciate being here, and thank you for being, you know, open enough to invite us, the CDC folks. I don't see Rob in the room, if I'm missing him. Oh, there he is. Hey, Rob. Rob Chapman is here, and I will evoke his name a few times. I don't know how I ended up doing the slides, but I did want to give kind of three quick things, and I have a bunch of slides in here that are really just for reference. We're hopefully going to have electronic copies for folks, and we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, making these slides available to anyone who, you know, maybe didn't have a chance to be in the room. Three quick things, and this was something I realized sadly later than it probably should have, the aha moment. A lot of folks in the room may not know that jurisdiction of operations, I guess, for HAN switched at CDC in about February-ish and then officially transitioned in July from part of our agency, the National Center for Public Health Informatics, which now does the infrastructure. Operations moved over to the National Center for Health Marketing, to the Emergency Communications System, which is where I come in. An aha moment occurred to me, you know, before this, but it was really driven home by the wonderful state presentations that to the states, the HAN systems are really kind of a hybrid of what CDC considers the HAN system and EPIX. And I can stand here wearing both hats because I'm also the team lead for EPIX, which is our secure alerting system. You have a secure component in a lot of states. I know that all states may not fit the bill here, but most of the states that Rob's told me about have a secure component, you know, have some kind of authentication process, some kind of verification process, things like that. That's really the venue of EPIX at the federal level. And HAN, we consider not secure. It could end up on CNN 5 minutes after sending it out, and you know, content is prepared and cleared with that in mind. So I just wanted to say that. That's one of those aha moments I probably should have had back in July, but I didn't have till about maybe 2 weeks ago. The other thing is I definitely want to say that one of the things that Rob and I are totally on the same page about is cascade alerting, and I have a little bullet here on a slide later, but you know, we've definitely listened to the presentations. We've had some great conference calls with the community of practice. And you know, cascade alerting is where we need to go. And I'll explain a little bit. I think everybody has their own idea of what cascade alerting means, but it's a more two-way, you know, exchange of information. Not only us just putting stuff out to the states and, you know, certainly saying, okay, hopefully you're gonna turn around and send it out. There were definitely some growing pains, as some folks know in the room, that when we took over in July and then H1N1 started, and he learned a quick couple of lessons there the hard way by failure, mainly in, you know, making sure we weren't sending administrative messages out through Health Alert Network and some other things. But we have learned from that, and I believe we're going forward. And really one of the points raised in a couple of the state presentations was to really clarify the use of the different levels of HAN. There's a health alert. Well, alert you should pay attention to. Then we have our advisory. Okay, well, it's not as critical as an alert. You don't have to drop everything, but it's important. Then we have an update, which, again, you think, okay, update's a little less important or certainly less vital. And then we have information services, Han, which we still don't, I think, know what we intend to do with that one, but we're talking about it. And then, of course, we have a category of other, administrative, system outage, you know, commercials, I suppose. If we need budget money, we can maybe, you know, put some eBay ads out there. I'm just kidding. But, you know, we're wrestling with that as we speak. And I just want you guys to know that you know, Rob's group and my group, we're talking about that because we really don't want to get into this Han fatigue. You know, we get it too. And we send out multiple alerts. Somebody said, you know, 20 conference calls a day. Your brain just can't process that kind of information. So we're working on that. And also hopefully to be able to better differentiate. This is something if you know, get it at 3 a.m, it's hopefully worth getting it at 3 a.m. on the West Coast. And it's something that's, you know, appropriate to get at 3 a.m. versus something that could wait till the next business day. As well as when we put it out, it doesn't necessarily mean that the states have to turn around and do the same thing. We certainly leave it up to the judgment of the Han coordinators to say, hey, this really isn't that important to wake everybody up in my whole state, and I'm going to send it out at 8 tomorrow morning. Perfectly appropriate. So those were a couple of quick things I just want to say. I'm going to blow through a lot of my slides. Like I said, a lot of them are for reference. This mainly just shows what I talked about a little bit of the switchover that happened in July. That the, did we have a pointer? Oh well, I'll point. The Han system came into the emergency communications system. We're actually the emergency risk communications branch for those CDC trivia experts. Some of the other teams in the branch, which magically becomes the Joint Information Center, because we've talked about NIMS components. When the Emergency Operations Center at CDC is activated, ECS, basically the same team, same personnel, all of a sudden call ourselves the Joint Information Center and integrate into the Emergency Operations Center that way through NIMS. So as you can see, the teams are fairly self-explanatory. You know, we work in partnership with the clinician communication team. Having been a former clinician communication team member, I have to say that we actually consider public health workers, public health staff, as clinicians. They're not healthcare providers necessarily, but they're clinicians. So we really have a good partnership with the clinician team, as well as EPIX again, of course, because I'm up here speaking for Han. So it's one of those sensible moments that leadership had at CDC to say, Han and EPIX, there's really a lot that overlaps, and there's definitely a difference, the main part being secure and not secure. But there's so much overlap, it really makes sense to have it in the same place. This is just our definition. Again, it's just for reference. Janet and I were talking before the presentation that this definition is, I think, a work in progress still. We've gotten some unofficial feedback from the state folks here who won't be named, but I'm glad they spoke up, that this definition is not exactly what the states think sometimes. And again, I think the goal, and one of the goals from the community of practice, and Chuck is over there, you know, what we need to do is come up with a mutually acceptable definition that, you know, we may never agree to every period or you know, the, but we need to make sure that we agree with it and there's parts that we may agree to disagree because it's really all about collaboration. The system is, you know, thankfully stronger than the sum of its parts, but it can also sometimes be weaker than the sum of its parts. So CDC Han, again, I won't belabor this, but basically the two bullets I want to talk about on here are the third one down, defined structure, content, and descriptive attributes. That's something else we're working on. I mentioned that we're working on really clarifying the levels. It is sad to say that we don't really have a comprehensive outline for the programs within CDC of how to draft the Han. I mean, we get all kinds of stuff, you know, very formal, you know, publication-worthy documents, and then we'll get something that someone wrote on a sticky note. And I know that's an exaggeration, but that kind of dichotomy of, you know, what? We need more than this. It's not enough to say, you know, go tell everybody to get a tetanus shot. Why? So that's one of the things we're working on as far as operations. This is just our performance objective. We're funded by the Coordinating Office for Terrorism Preparedness and Emergency Response at CDC. So, of course, we have metrics on how we're doing. This is a pretty straightforward one. Thankfully, as someone asked in the rehearsal, our time clock starts ticking when we receive the message. The group that the team, the EPIX team and the HON team, don't really get involved with either the message drafting or the clearance. Whew, thankfully, on the clearance aspect. So once we're given the final cleared HON to send, that's when the clock starts. I won't belabor this. Again, it's very similar to, you know, what the states, and it's actually wonderfully refreshing to hear the states, you know, have really a robust systems in place, not only in these presentations today, but also in the community of practice calls. I have a case study, which I won't get into. I want to go to the last slide here because I'm on my 2 minutes. But again, these are going to be available for folks as reference. So this is something Rob and I think are passionate about together. You know, we need to do a bunch of improvements to the system. We need to make the system work better. I believe that bringing HON and EPIX together in the same team operationally is one step in that direction. I definitely think it helps us communicate with the folks. I mean, it's nice to finally meet the people face-to-face that I've been on conference calls with. I think everyone involved is very passionate about making this work. And it is. It's kind of like a marriage. You're stuck with each other. You got to make it work. Maybe marriage is, I guess you'd get a divorce, but we really do need to make it work. It is a partnership. Again, I mentioned cascade alerting, and I will use it in my last couple of seconds. Cascade alerting, I think, is really something that we're both firmly, you know, committed to try to develop. And to us, cascade alerting is cascading. Not only us sending out information to the state, certainly, but as the examples given of locally kind of created HON messages, well, that needs to come up to CDC too for a couple of reasons. Definitely for situational awareness, you know, surveillance intelligence data, as well as, okay, maybe we're seeing, you know, Arizona send something up and Texas send something up. Well, they don't know about each other, but all of a sudden we're looking at, interesting. Maybe they're connected, maybe they're not. But certainly we probably need to disseminate that information. So we could then turn around and recascade it down. As well as, again, perhaps, I don't think it's, you know, utter speculation to say that we could come up with MOUs or, you know, definitely protocols for states to be able to trigger their own. You know, certainly regional issues, and there's many I could rattle off, Midwest mumps, certainly West Nile virus, any border health kind of issues. Definitely are, you know, you want your co-jurisdiction, your neighbor, to know what's going on, as well as to be able to filter that data into you to be able to manage that incident. So just my emails, BRT0, or if you want to spell out jschwendinger@cdc.gov. You can always email healthalert@cdc.gov. Exciting thing is we're pending on some new email addresses in conjunction with clarifying that routine administrative messages will come from this mailbox so it doesn't trigger a cascade at the state level. That was my mea culpa, sending out an administrative message from Health Alert, not realizing it woke everybody up in the whole state. I'm sorry. But we're going to come out with, you know, administrationhon@cdc.gov or something that's fairly intuitive so that you know that you can not only send your system, now I got to run, you didn't know it was me. So you can not only make your system, you know, not cascade something administratively at 3 a.m, but you can get in your head as far as the Emergency Operations Center, okay, I don't have to drop everything to look at this admin notice or system outage notice. So thank you so much. If there's any questions, shoot us an email, and we want to try to get the system working.
We realized that we're running out of time, and we were going to have a quick little discussion on how the different states used their health alert networks during H1N1. And instead, I'm going to ask the presenters to come up and answer any questions that you may have. And we would welcome you also to come to the Community of Practice meeting tomorrow night. In Hanover rooms A and B from 5:30 to 8 o'clock, where we can discuss how we use the HON during H1N1, what we're doing, some of our best practices, and just get to know each other a little bit better. So if the presenters would come up, we'll start fielding questions. Yeah. Just so you can all take a shot at them, I guess.
A rose between all these thorns.
That's right.
Can we get HON coordinators to stand up?
Oh, yeah. Anybody who's a HON coordinator, will you please stand so we can acknowledge you?
Bravo.